Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Lisa Johnson. In this episode, we look at new research in cervical cancer, lupus, gene therapy for immune deficiency, and malaria prevention in infants. We review hair loss in women, follow a case of tuberculosis in advanced HIV, and hear perspectives on vaccines, primary care, digital health, infection surveillance, AI in disaster response, Medicare policy, and bearing witness in conflict zones. Sentinel lymph node biopsy alone or with lymph adenectomy in cervical cancer, by Hua Tu, from the Sun Yat-sen University Cancer Center, Guangzhou, China, and co-authors. Cervical cancer is the most common gynecologic cancer in developing countries and resource-limited regions. The cornerstone of treatment for early-stage disease remains radical hysterectomy with pelvic lymphadenectomy, complete dissection of lymphoid tissues surrounding the iliac vessels. Sentinel lymph node biopsy is a less invasive approach aimed at precisely dissecting the nodes that carry the highest risk of metastasis. This trial enrolled 838 patients with cervical cancer that was stage 1A1 with lymphovascular invasion, 1A2, 1B1, or 2A1. All the patients underwent radical hysterectomy, except for those with stage 1A1 cancer, who underwent simple hysterectomy. Sentinel lymph node biopsy was performed at the time of surgery and was followed by examination of frozen sections. Patients who had negative sentinel lymph nodes were intraoperatively assigned not to undergo pelvic lymphadenectomy or to undergo lymphadenectomy. Adjuvant therapy was provided according to a unified protocol. The 3-year disease-free survival was 94.6% in the lymphadenectomy group and 96.9% in the biopsy-only group. Sentinel lymph node biopsy alone was non-inferior to lymphadenectomy with respect to disease-free survival and was associated with fewer complications. Kristen Bixel from Stanford University, Palo Alto, California, writes in an editorial that cervical cancer remains a global health problem, with more than 600,000 new cases and more than 340,000 deaths estimated annually. Given the data from the trial by Tu and co-authors, sentinel lymph node biopsy should become the standard of care for patients with early-stage cervical cancer. However, questions remain. First, can sentinel lymph node biopsy alone be safely used for tumors that measure 3 to 4 centimeters? Second, is intraoperative preparation of frozen sections necessary or beneficial? Third, how should we manage low-volume nodal disease, specifically isolated tumor cells? Additionally, the findings raise questions with regard to potential differences in surgical technique or different physiological responses to various forms of surgery that may affect oncologic outcomes. A phase 3 trial of telitacicept for systemic lupus erythematosus by Ronald van Vollenhoven from the Amsterdam University Medical Center, the Netherlands, and co-authors. Systemic lupus erythematosus, SLE, is a serious chronic autoimmune disease. B lymphocytes play a central role in the pathogenesis of SLE. In a phase 2b trial, telitacicept, a new dual inhibitor of the cytokines B lymphocyte stimulator, BLyS, and APRIL, a proliferation-inducing ligand, showed efficacy in adults with active SLE when added to standard therapy. In this phase 3 trial in China, 355 participants with active SLE were randomly assigned to receive telitacicept or placebo subcutaneously once weekly for 52 weeks, in addition to standard therapy. The addition of telitacicept to standard therapy resulted in a significantly greater likelihood of a response on the modified SLE Responder Index 4 at week 52 than placebo plus standard therapy. Telitacicept was associated with increased upper respiratory infections, decreases in immunoglobulin levels, and increased injection site reactions. Long-term safety and efficacy of gene therapy for adenosine deaminase deficiency by Claire Booth from the University College London Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health and co-authors. Severe combined immunodeficiency due to adenosine deaminase deficiency, ADA-SCID, is a life-threatening inborn error of immunity for which lentiviral gene therapy has been investigated in clinical trials. In previous studies, these investigators reported that lentiviral gene therapy was safe and effective in 50 patients with ADA-SCID, with 100% overall survival and more than 95% event-free survival up to 36 months after infusion. The initial procedure was associated with no unacceptable side effects or complications, and most patients had full immune recovery and sustained metabolic detoxification, which led to a reduction in infections and the ability to stop enzyme replacement therapy and immunoglobulin replacement therapy. The investigators now report the long-term results in a cohort expanded to 62 patients with a median follow-up of 7.5 years and a follow-up duration of more than 10 years in 5 patients. The long-term findings demonstrate the sustained clinical efficacy and safety of the lentiviral gene therapy for ADA-SCID, indicating that it is a curative treatment. Mass administration of azithromycin to infants in Mali to reduce mortality by Fatima Sheikh Haidara from the Center for Vaccine Development, Mali, Bamako, and co-authors. Mass administration of azithromycin to children 1 to 59 months of age has been shown to reduce mortality among infants and children in this age group in some areas of sub-Saharan Africa. The largest effects have appeared to be among infants younger than 12 months of age, within 3 months after treatment. This observation motivated the design of the current trial, which evaluated the effects of mass administration of azithromycin in Mali, West Africa, targeting infants 1 to 11 months of age. Infants received azithromycin 2 times a year or 4 times a year, or placebo. The primary outcome was death within 3 months after eligibility had been confirmed. A total of 1,151 villages were enrolled in the trial. Mortality was 11.9 deaths per 1,000 person years at risk in the control group, 11.8 deaths per 1,000 person years in the twice-yearly azithromycin group, and 11.3 deaths per 1,000 person years in the quarterly azithromycin group. Mass administration of azithromycin in Mali, limited to infants 1 to 11 months of age, did not result in lower infant or child mortality than placebo, regardless of whether azithromycin was delivered twice yearly or quarterly.
I'm Darren Teichman, a deputy editor at the New England Journal of Medicine. I've been a full-time medical journal editor for over 15 years, but I've never stopped seeing patients. Just like the other full-time physician editors on our team, I continue to practice medicine for a couple of reasons. Most importantly, I love it. It's who I am. It's who I trained to be. I've known many of my patients for over 20 years, and I don't want to lose those connections. I also think seeing patients makes me a better editor. When we sit around the table and discuss papers, my colleagues and I can understand why the questions asked by the research studies we're considering are important or not to practicing clinicians because we see patients ourselves. I love this work because I always learn a lot. And the goal is simple, to help our authors clearly, honestly, and concisely communicate their findings to our readers so they, in turn, can use what they read to help their patients. It certainly helps me take better care of my patients. We're published by the Massachusetts Medical Society, a not-for-profit publisher, and we rely on subscriptions from individual readers, medical schools, and libraries to fund what we do.
Hair loss in women. A review article by Elise Olson from Duke University Medical Center, Durham, North Carolina. Female pattern hair loss is common and increases with age. Distinguishing between early onset and late onset female pattern hair loss and establishing the presence or absence of hyperandrogenism or hyperandrogenemia may identify subpopulations of patients with varied etiologic factors and treatment response. The major clinical features of female pattern hair loss are a pattern of central scalp hair loss with or without frontal accentuation, preservation of follicular ostia, and variation of hair shaft diameter. A scalp biopsy can confirm the disorder and determine the potential for regrowth. One treatment strategy for female pattern hair loss is to start with either 5% topical minoxidil twice a day or a low dose of oral minoxidil and escalate the latter if no unacceptable side effects occur, such as symptomatic low blood pressure, peripheral edema, or hypertrichosis. Antiandrogen agents or 5-alpha reductase inhibitors are effective treatments in women with female pattern hair loss and are useful in combination with minoxidil. For patients with female pattern hair loss who prefer to avoid medications or wish to augment their medical therapy, microneedling, platelet-rich plasma, non-ablative fractional laser treatment, and low-level light therapy may be useful. A 43-year-old woman with depression, suicidal ideation, and fever. A case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by Michael Abers and colleagues. A 43-year-old woman with advanced HIV infection and bipolar disorder was admitted for worsening depression and suicidal ideation. She described a 2-month history of non-productive cough without weight loss or night sweats. On evaluation, she was somnolent, diaphoretic, and hypotensive, with an initial low-grade fever. That evening, her temperature spiked to 39.5 degrees Celsius, accompanied by tachycardia, tachypnea, hypoxemia, and an ashen appearance with increased work of breathing. Chest X-ray revealed innumerable micronodules in a miliary pattern throughout both lungs. Miliary nodules, named for their resemblance to millet seeds, arise from the hematogenous spread of underlying disease, which is typically granulomatous or malignant in nature. Laboratory testing showed profound immunosuppression with a CD4 count of 25 per microliter and high HIV viral load. Her history also included unstable housing, cocaine and tobacco use, and significant psychosocial stressors. Further evaluation with induced sputum, biopsy, and nucleic acid testing confirmed disseminated Mycobacterium tuberculosis infection, consistent with miliary tuberculosis. Risk and Benefit, a perspective by Eric Rubin, editor-in-chief for the journal. According to the National Safety Council, the lifetime risk of dying in a motor vehicle accident in 2023 was 1 in 95, a little over 1%. Despite this, most of us drive on a daily basis. We are all making a calculation. Driving is important for our jobs and lifestyles, and the risk is quite low. While we may know the risks of driving, we feel they are far exceeded by the benefits. Recently, that common sense has been lost in our national discussion of vaccination. Available vaccines are far safer than driving, with risks of serious injury generally well below 0.1% and fatality rates far lower still. Vaccines are powerful tools. They have made one scourge, smallpox, extinct, and have come close to eliminating others, such as measles, at least in the United States. And given the herd immunity that vaccination promotes, not only does a vaccine protect you, but it also helps protect those like your infant, who is too young to be vaccinated, and those who might have a decreased immune response to vaccinations, such as your elderly parents and your aunt who is receiving chemotherapy. Altogether, vaccination has saved millions of lives and continues to protect us today. Despite this, vaccination is under attack. Recent discussions, including those of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices and Congress's Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations, have focused primarily on purported risks. These risks are often inflated and rely on poor quality evidence that ignores definitive studies demonstrating low risk and high efficacy. Some are outright lies. It is time for the federal government to take back the driver's seat and focus on real data about vaccination to protect the nation's health. Is a long simmering crisis boiling over? U.S. Primary Care Today, a Medicine and Society article on the primary care puzzle by Lisa Rosenbaum, a national correspondent for the journal. After her internal medicine residency, Dr. H. joined a Midwestern practice, inheriting a primary care patient panel from a retiring endocrinologist. At first, the work was hard for the right reasons. She diagnosed and treated a wide range of diseases, built long-term relationships with patients and families, and, until the rise of hospitalists, cared for them in the hospital as well. Becoming the consummate internist was exactly what she'd signed up for. She didn't recognize that this traditional generalist role was in peril until about 15 years later, when she joined a multi-specialty practice owned by a nonprofit foundation. The work was initially fulfilling, but as the insults to primary care accumulated, shorter visits, unmanageable inboxes, a staff exodus during the COVID pandemic, Dr. H. gradually lost her capacity to function as her patient's doctor. Like many primary care physicians, she adjusted to the squeeze by working more. When leadership threatened to cut physicians' vacation days if their documentation was late, she started spending hours at night charting. But one change she couldn't work around was the lost capacity to see her patients when they were sick. Forbidden from double booking to accommodate them, she often didn't hear about patients who needed her until after a centralized triage system had diverted them to urgent care. As such situations, often with much higher stakes, recurred, she began wondering, what does it mean to be someone's doctor if you can't be there for them when they need you? The primary care physician's role has been hollowed out by modern medicine's dictates and changing social norms. Lisa Rosenbaum asks, can and should the system be saved? The contribution of digital treatment to efforts to reduce global tobacco use. A perspective by Felix Naughton from the University of East Anglia, Norwich, and Abhijit Nadkarni from London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, both in the United Kingdom. Opportunities for using digital tools to access tobacco cessation treatment are growing rapidly. The number of people using tobacco cessation apps worldwide was projected to increase from 5 million in 2022 to 33 million in 2026. In part because of an increase in the proportion of the global population with access to a mobile phone, 71% in 2024. 4 in 5 of these devices are smartphones, a figure predicted to rise to 9 in 10 by 2030. High-income countries tend to have the highest rates of mobile phone access, but many low- and middle-income countries, LMICs, are quickly closing this gap. A key strength of digital tobacco treatments is their potential to be delivered at low cost. It can cost $100 in practitioner time to deliver a traditional 8-week tobacco treatment program to an individual patient, for example. Whereas an app that costs $100,000 to develop will cost only 10 cents per user to deliver if 1 million people use it. Low-cost cessation support tools with broad reach are critical in LMICs in particular, given the inadequate financial and human resources of their healthcare systems. Broadly, digital tobacco treatments can be divided into two categories: interventions that attempt to replicate human-delivered support, and interventions that provide forms of support that humans cannot deliver, such as just-in-time interventions, which may help prevent lapses. The extent to which these tools will help reduce global tobacco use is unclear, but such interventions hold great promise, particularly amid conceptual and technological advances. Advancing surveillance of healthcare-associated infections, targeting hospital-onset sepsis. A perspective by Fizza Manzoor from Harvard Medical School, Boston, and co-authors. In the United States, healthcare-associated infections are detected in 1 in 31 hospitalized patients, cause about 72,000 deaths each year, and cost the healthcare system billions of dollars each year. Despite these substantial clinical and economic effects, surveillance of healthcare-associated infections in U.S. hospitals is limited. Federal reporting requirements focus on just 6 healthcare-associated infections: hospital-onset C. difficile, central venous catheter-associated bloodstream infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus bacteremia, surgical site infections occurring after abdominal hysterectomy, and surgical site infections occurring after colorectal surgery. This approach results in many serious infections going unmonitored, which undermines efforts to understand and prevent the full breadth of nosocomial infections. The CDC has established a metric relying on automated surveillance that could provide a more comprehensive view of severe nosocomial infections. The CDC's hospital-onset sepsis metric provides a promising pathway to extend nosocomial infection surveillance and may also help address gaps in prevention. The AI frontier in humanitarian aid: embracing possibilities and addressing risks. A perspective by Michelle Barry from the Stanford University School of Medicine, California, and co-authors. During disasters, timely response is critical. For example, after an earthquake, such as the 7.7 magnitude earthquake that devastated Myanmar in March 2025, people who are trapped under collapsed buildings face a steep decline in their chance of survival after 48 hours. Yet, the scope of devastation, combined with limited resources for disaster response and uncertainty about on-the-ground conditions, can constrain rescue efforts. Responders have recently had a new tool at their disposal, however: artificial intelligence, AI. Shortly after the Myanmar earthquake, a satellite captured images of the affected area, which were sent to Microsoft's AI for Good lab. Machine learning tools were used to analyze the images and assess the location, extent, nature, and severity of the damage. Such information, which was gained without the grave risks inherent to entering an unstable disaster zone, and much more rapidly than would have been possible with traditional data gathering and analysis methods, can help organizations quickly and safely prioritize relief efforts in areas that are both highly damaged and densely populated. This example reflects one of several ways in which AI is being used to support humanitarian efforts in disaster and conflict zones. Yet there are substantial challenges and risks associated with deploying new AI technologies in complex healthcare settings, such as cost or the potential for security breaches and human rights or ethics violations. Proliferation of prior authorization in traditional Medicare. None the wiser? A perspective by Michael Liu from the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, Boston. Prior authorization policies, which require clinicians to obtain a payer's approval before delivering particular medical services, have gained traction among private insurers as a mechanism for reducing expenditures. However, the use of prior authorization in traditional Medicare, which covers more than 33 million adults, has historically been limited, since the program's legacy fee-for-service architecture has prioritized post-payment audits over real-time reviews. In a major policy shift, however, CMS in June 2025 announced the Wasteful and Inappropriate Service Reduction, WISER, model, which will expand prior authorization in traditional Medicare. Under the WISER model, technology-enabled prior authorization will be used to assess the necessity of selected services in traditional Medicare, with goals of reducing low-value care, cutting costs, and expediting decision-making. The initial phase will run for 6 years in 6 states, Arizona, New Jersey, Ohio, Oklahoma, Texas, and Washington. 17 medical services, such as deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease and incontinence control devices, were selected for inclusion because, for example, there is evidence of fraud or waste in their use, previous research has classified them as low-value care, or Medicare Advantage plans require prior authorization for their use. Curbing fraud, abuse, and waste is important, but CMS recently acknowledged the urgent need to fix prior authorization processes used by Medicare Advantage and other commercial plans. WISER risks undermining these goals and moving traditional Medicare in the opposite direction. On Bearing Witness, a perspective by Samer Attar, from Northwestern University, Chicago. Why should we bear witness to others' suffering, knowing that it may scar our minds or stain our conscience? In part, it's because when we meet someone in distress or read in the news about victims of a bomb, a flood, or an illness, they are all of us. The space between us connects us more than it separates us. That's why the Talmud and the Quran both teach that saving one life is like saving the whole world. Their scriptural meaning is both literal and symbolic. Dr. Attar is an American surgeon, and he has worked in Syria, Ukraine, and Gaza. Dr. Attar has been to Gaza 6 times since December 2023, and he has operated at 7 hospitals. All of which have since been sieged, bombed, or demolished. Several of his Palestinian colleagues have been injured or killed working on ambulances or in medical centers. Dr. Attar has no bullet or shrapnel wounds, but the scars that are hardest to heal can't be seen. What did he witness? What did all of it teach him? As with physical wounds, constantly digging into and picking at psychic scars can infect one's soul and make one's mind brittle, rigid, and breakable. But with appropriate care, and if we give our bodies the space and stillness to breathe and heal, our scars can be humble reminders. They can give us the courage and the resilience to stay standing, to build an open mind, a soft heart, and steeled nerves, a balance that takes daily practice against the weight of the world. In our images in clinical medicine, a 52-year-old man was admitted with septic shock. He had a history of splenectomy and hypogammaglobulinemia after CAR T-cell therapy for lymphoma 3 years earlier. Encapsulated diplococci were seen in 20% of his neutrophils. In another image, a 23-year-old man with autism spectrum disorder and a history of severe constipation presented with abdominal pain, nausea, and vomiting. CT showed colonic distension, mural thickening, and perirectal fat stranding. A diagnosis of Sturkerl colitis was made. In Sturkerl colitis, chronically impacted feces distend the colon, resulting in inflammation. In some cases, the fecaloma may lead to focal pressure necrosis or perforation. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Tell us what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.